Thank you for tuning in to the Essential Church Podcast, a church where we focus on restoration over denomination. If you're in the Virginia Beach area and would like to find out more about Essential Church, visit our webpage at essentialchurch.com.
I always love starting a new series, in part because I spend, you know, quite a bit of time sort of like thinking about the series and what's coming next, and I get all this stuff like all welled up in me at the beginning of a series. I just can't wait for like to explode out and share it. And this is one of those series because this series is about the Bible, and all summer long we're going to be sort of trying to give you an understanding and overview of the Bible. So many people don't read the Bible because they don't understand what it is, or like AJ there who looks at the Bible sort of from a wrong perspective. And because he's looking at it from a wrong perspective and doesn't really understand what the Bible is or even what kind of literature it is, he's trying to extrapolate things in a completely odd sort of way. I mean, he basically comes to the conclusion that when it comes to the Bible, it's such a kind of a crazy, arcane book. You just got to pick and choose whatever works for you. And I disagree. I don't think you pick and choose whatever works for you. I think you need to get into it and immerse yourself in understanding what kind of book it really is. And he was looking at the Bible as though it was some sort of like how-to manual for life. And I've heard a lot of people call the Bible sort of a manual for life. After all, Bible spells out basic instructions before leaving Earth. That's what the Bible really is, right? And well, yes and no. It's not really a how-to manual. It's not really an encyclopedia of life. And trying to treat the Bible and just kind of randomly go through and look for 700 commands out of it is sort of like saying, hey, who's the main character in the dictionary? What's the plot? Can you tell me exactly what's going on in there? And you'd be like, what are you talking about? It's a dictionary. It's a reference book. There's no plot. There's no story. There's no main character. It's a reference book. So why are we treating the Bible like it's a reference book? Because clearly there is a main character. Clearly there is a plot. Clearly there is a story weaved throughout the book. The Bible is a story. It's a story from beginning to end. It's a story about God's relationship with humanity. And if you don't understand that it's a story and you look to it as a reference book, then you're not really going to understand it, and you're going to come to a conclusion, well, I guess you just randomly pick and choose what it is you do out of it. It's kind of like if I were to tell you the story of World War II, and I were explaining to you how we got into the war and why we were in the war, what was involved in the war, what was at stake in the war, and I explained to you that Americans went over there and they fought and they killed Germans because of the issues that were going on, and then I tell you after the war was over, we went and we helped rebuild Germany, and you then just kind of took that and said, okay, so pretty much what it is Americans went over there and some killed Germans and some helped rebuild with the Germans, and they just kind of did whatever they wanted to. So you could kind of choose which one you wanted to do. You'd be like, no. Well, I'm just taking your story literally, and you said that there was a command to kill Germans and there was a command to help rebuild the Germans, and so, you know, which one is it? I guess they just got to choose which one they did? You'd say, that's not taking it literally, that's just stupidity. I mean, you're not following the story. There was a storyline going on there, and in the context of the story, there were commands and there were orders that generals gave, but it was within the context of the story. And if you take away the story and you just have the commands, you're going to look like an idiot. Well, I say that. I think New York's the only city in the world where you could walk around in that kind of get up, and people don't look at you. They just kind of smile and just kind of like, okay, whatever, it's New York, you know? And what he does is absurd because he's not understanding that it's a story. And I think sometimes we get mad at the fact that the Bible is primarily story. Like, don't you wish that the Bible was like a how-to guide for life? Don't you wish like you could just open up and say, okay, marriage, what does God say about marriage? And just kind of have like a chapter on marriage with a bunch of bullet points on what do I do when she says something? And then there'd be like another chapter on parenting, you know, what to do with, you know, kids when they blank. And then there'd be like a whole other chapter just on the teenage years and what to do when they blank. And you could just kind of look it up and, you know, we just need to read chapter 3 so we can get through the teenage years. And how many of you ever wish the Bible was like that, where you could just kind of read it like a manual? Some of you, you sort of know that it's story, but you don't really understand kind of the flow of the story. And so like, I want to read the whole Bible. And so you start off Genesis 1, you kind of get through Genesis. Then somewhere around Leviticus, you're like, I'm not doing this anymore. And it's because you kind of don't understand really the flow of the story and how to read it or where you're at in the story. And so the Bible is a story. And then you might say, well, why is it that God chose story? Why not just the bullet points? Well, I've been listening to a book called Talk Like TED, and TED Talks, that's an excerpt of one of the local TED Talks. Anybody all know what TED Talks are? Any of y'all? Basically, it's where really smart people who have studied a topic for years and years and years of their life and have sold probably a million books on the topic will get up and in 20 minutes summarize their entire life's work for you for free. So I love it. And the thing is they coach them on how to speak, and they're very effective speakers. Even if they aren't good speakers, they coach them so well that the presentations are amazing. And so, you know, I do a lot of talks and presentations and I want to be able to get better at what I do, I started listening to this book on Talk Like TED. And he gives like 9 bullet points of what they do. And right at the very beginning, right after being able to speak with passion, 2, the second most important thing is to tell stories. And the reason why is he talks in there about how when engineers go off and they learn new things and they want to share them with the world, and they come in, they try to give them some sort of technical description about how what they've learned or what they've discovered is going to change your life because it does all these things. People kind of look at him, they have this glazed eye over, and they're like, yeah, whatever. And he says, and they don't get funded, and nobody buys the product because the engineering stories and the bullet points of the how-tos and the product improvements, nobody really has time for that. They don't really listen. They don't really connect with that. He says, but when these same engineers can tell a story about how this product has impacted somebody or how it's changed the way somebody's seen life or what it's done for somebody, and they get wrapped up in the story, that's what moves people, and that's when projects get funded, and that's when products start moving off the shelves. And they talked in there about how stories move you emotionally. For instance, when maybe you've experienced this, that they talk about how when the storyteller tells the story, they actually relive the emotions of the story. You ever told a story and every time you tell it, you tear up? Or every time you tell the story, like you start laughing because of how funny that was? Like you can't help tell the story about what happened last summer without starting to laugh. Well, what was interesting, they did these some studies. I was reading about this in the book. They did some studies where not only does the storyteller relive those experiences emotionally, but the person hearing the story relives those experiences emotionally, even though they were never there. And you've done this. Anybody ever cried at a movie? Anybody? Now, if there's a man whose hand's up, it better be Old Yeller. Not Beaches. I'm just saying. Whatever. Or it could be when Han died. I'm just saying. And if you haven't seen it yet, well, then, you know, you're not a Star Wars fan anyway. So, but you get emotionally wrapped up in the story, and it pulls you in, and it draws your heart. And it talks about how story is what makes people move. Story is what calls people to action. Story is what helps people change their minds about a situation or a problem. And you could hear a statistic about all the people who are without food. But if I show you and tell you one story about one person who's without food, you'll be likely to move and take action on that. And so story is very powerful. And of course, this isn't news to God. God's like, yeah, why do you think that's why I told stories? All I did was story, story, story. Because if I just gave you a bullet point of the how-tos, it wouldn't move humanity. And so the Bible is primarily story. And there's one big overarching story. In the midst of that, there's several small narratives which deal with that major story. And so what I want to do this summer is sort of work through the 5 acts or the 5 acts of this sort of 5-act play that is the Bible. And this morning, I'm just going to kind of give you an overview of what we'll be doing this summer and move through the different acts. And if you don't understand these acts and the sequence of the story, you don't understand any of the commands. There are commands in the Bible, but they're within the story. And there are things to believe in the story, but they're within the context of the story. And if you try to extrapolate that out and just say, well, the Bible is about a bunch of commands and beliefs. If you don't do them, then God's going to punish you forever. No, you're missing the story. And so act 1 of the story is the beginning of the creation, how all things were made, where everything came from, the origins of all time. And this is what primarily found in Genesis chapter 1 and 2. It says, in the beginning, God created. And you see, you have to know that in the beginning, God created, because if you don't know that, you don't know your place in the story. And think about how many people are misguided in life because they don't know the story. They don't know where they fit in this story. That's why this series is called Our Place in His Story or History. History is His Story. And if you don't understand that we were created, you'll begin to think that we were here by accident. And if you think we're here by accident, then life doesn't have any meaning. And if you talk to the atheist who doesn't have a concept of God and being created by God, they'll tell you flat out, there is no meaning in life outside of an understanding that we are created by God. So it's very fundamental that you understand act 1 of the play is you were created. Now, anybody ever been to a movie and somebody wanted popcorn right as the movie was starting? Or maybe you had to go to the bathroom when the movie started and you missed the first 5 minutes. And then you come in, you say, what happened? And they're like, whoa, shh, 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 shh. And the whole movie, you're completely lost because you don't know what happened in the first 5 minutes. Anybody with me on this? Okay. So that's kind of what happens in the Bible. So you got to know that we're created. We were created. We're not here by accident. You also need to know that we were created in the image of God. And many people don't understand we're made in the image of God. They think we somehow we find our origins in animals. And so they will tell you, and you watch the Discovery Channel long enough, you'll see this. They'll basically say, if you want to know how to have a better relationship with other people, you need to look at monkeys or look at animals and how they interact. And we have a lot to learn because that's where we came from. That's where origins is. And so we can learn a lot from them. And the biblical story says, no, 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 if you want to learn how to interact, you need to learn and see how God has interacted with humanity because you're made in the image of God, not flowing out of an animal. And how crazy and insane is it that somebody would look to a monkey and try to figure out, you know, how is it we're supposed to interact? Or also in creation, you realize that the intrinsic value of humanity, that humans are uniquely different than animals. And a lot of people in America realize we don't know act one of the story. Because when it comes down to choosing between a gorilla and a small boy, they shot the gorilla. And how many people in this country came out and said, how could you choose gorilla over humanity? They're both equal. They don't know the story. You can't blame them. They don't understand act one of the story. They missed that. They were out getting popcorn somewhere. They didn't understand that human beings are uniquely different than animals. And there's an intrinsic value to human life that's different than that of animals. And so act one is very, very important. And God looks at everything that he made and he says it was good. And so when you enjoy a beautiful sunset or sunrise or a mountain view and you go, wow, this is amazing, and you enjoy the beauty of it, you're just identifying with what God has already said about creation. It is good. But then you might say, well, but not everything's good. What about all the stuff that's not so good? You know, why did God create all the stuff that's not so good? Whoa, you're getting ahead of yourself. That's act two. Act one is God created and said it was good, but in act two is the fall. And that's found in Genesis chapter 3 through 11. And then that same fall story is played out again and again throughout the rest of the Bible. And then the same fall story is played out again and again in our lives. And week after week after week, we go back and we relive Genesis 3. And we take our place and identify right with Adam and Eve's decision to take the forbidden fruit. How many of us have taken that forbidden fruit time and time and time again? It is our story. And you have to understand that part of our story is the fall, that God created things were good, and then there was the fall. And when the fall happened, entered into the world was oppression and injustice and violence. And now that you know, you have marriages that are dividing, and Adam and Eve are pointing fingers at each other, and brothers are now fighting, and murder enters into the scene. And then by chapter 6, I think it's Lamech or whatever his name is, adultery and lust enters the scene. He decides he's not going to be satisfied with just one woman. He's got to have another one. And so polygamy enters in, and lust and everything else goes down that same pattern with the fall. And Act 2 tells us that things aren't as they were supposed to be. That what you see around you isn't how the world's supposed to be. Because a lot of people say, well, no, everything is that how it is? And so it's a dog-eat-dog world, and so it's the survival of the fittest, so that's why I'm out doing what I can do, because I'm looking out for number one. But that's not how things were supposed to be. That's not how we were created to be. We weren't created to be a dog-eat-dog society. We're always looking out for number one. That's not how things were intended to be. That's a result of the fall. That's a misguided, it's a dysfunction. That's not going to work in the end, because it's part of the fall. Or beginning to think that the main problem in the world is something other than sin, because in Act 2, it tells us that sin is the problem that plagues humanity. And because we don't realize that, because as a people, we don't understand that sin is our major problem. We think that a technological advance is what's going to propel humanity into the future, or a medical advance, where if we can just cure cancer, then we can be, you know, rid ourselves of death. No, no, no. While as important and as good as technological advances and medical advances are to our well-being, they're not going to produce immortality. You have to know that sin is the root problem. Or somehow thinking that better education is going to solve all the problems of society. No, that the problem of society is the heart, and the heart is deceitfully wicked above all things. It says in Genesis chapter 6 that the Lord saw how great the wickedness was of the human race and how it had become on the earth, that every inclination of the thoughts of the human heart was only evil all the time. Later on in Jeremiah 17, it says the heart is deceitfully wicked above all things and beyond cure. And with all due respect to John Lennon, who just believed if we could just didn't have countries or borders or religion or possessions, then we would all get along. No, the hippie experiment failed. It was a failed experiment because you got rid of all that stuff, and what still remained was the wicked, sinful human heart that doesn't care about other people's needs ahead of their own. And so as long as that sin is there, as long as that problem persists, any other solution is not going to solve the problem, if you don't realize what the real problem is the wickedness of the human heart. So what's God going to do? Well, one suggestion, of course, comes up time and time again. We just need to get rid of all of the bad people in the world. And if we could just get rid of all the bad people in the world, then the world would be a better place. And God's like, well, we did that. Read Genesis chapter 6, 7, 8, 9. There was a flood. I killed all the bad people. I left one, you know, good family there. But that didn't seem to solve the problem, because shortly thereafter, that one good guy, that one shining example of humanity, gets drunk and naked and passed out. His son pulls out a Sharpie and writes on his forehead. And all of humanity continues to have problems. Read it. Read your Bible sometime. See if I'm lying to you. Don't tell me about they didn't have Sharpies back then. You figure it out. I don't know. That's the way I read it in the Bible I read. It just seemed like he pulled out a Sharpie and he wrote on his forehead and got in trouble for it. So you read it and see. Don't watch the movie. Don't watch the Genesis movie. Read the book. The book is always better than the movie in this case. So what's God going to do? Punishing sin is not going to restore the relationship that was lost. It's not a cure. It's not a cure for the real problem of sin in the heart. So what happens in Act 3? God seeks to win back the heart of humanity. And the scene shifts over to a person in a place with a guy named Abram that God changes the name to Abraham, and in the land of Israel. And he says, Abraham, you and I, we got a good thing going. And I want everybody to see the good thing that we've got going. I'm going to bless the socks off of you. And the hope, the vision, the goal here is when people see the relationship that we have, and they see how you are blessed, they'll want what you've got, and they'll want to come to you and say, what is it that you've got? What's different about you? And therefore, I'll be able to bless all nations through you. And so the promise that comes to him in Genesis 12, and then said again in Genesis chapter 22, is I will make you into a great nation, Abraham, and I will bless you and make you famous, and you'll be a blessing to others, and all nations will be blessed through you. Now, the problem was, is somewhere along the way, they distorted that, and the sin entered back in, and it went from, I'm going to bless all nations through you, to, well, don't you wish you could be me and have what I got, because I'm special, because I was born in the right family, and you're not, so you're on the outs. And so it became this exclusive club somehow. And God's like, no, the goal, the design was, the idea was, you ever seen another couple and just said, man, I don't know what they've got going on in their marriage, but I wish we had a marriage like that. Or you ever been at Walmart and you see this mom who's got six kids? She's in Walmart with six kids alone. You would never in a million years try to do that with your own three kids. And so here's this lady just walking through. She's got the baby on a hip. Three of the kids are actually, you know, doing the grocery shopping on her behalf. One of the kids is watching the younger kid. And she's just strolling through, just kind of minding. And you're like, how on earth? Meanwhile, your kids, you're running all over the place. Don't even know where two of them are. And you're like, I want whatever she's doing, I need to be doing, right? That was the picture of what God was trying to do through Abraham. And so he begins this relationship and says, I'm going to bless you, and I'm going to make you my people, and I'm going to give you a new identity, and that you're my child, and I'm your God. I'm like your father, and you're like my child, and we're going to have this relationship like a husband would to a wife that loves and loves and loves beyond all things. And so God begins to try to win back the heart of humanity. In the midst of all that, he gives them some laws, some guidelines on how to live. And you know, what's lost in this story is before the law was given in the Bible, laws were always determined by whoever had the most power, right? So it was never about what was intrinsically right. It was about whoever's in power. Might makes right, was always was, right? What the law was is whatever the king decided. And you see this reflected, you know, even in our own times, back in, you know, in ancient times. If you go to the book of Esther, the Queen Vashti says some things to the king that he doesn't like. And people are like, hey, king, you got to do something here, because, you know, if she does that, then all women do that. So you got to decree that women need to learn their place. That's right. We're going to teach that women need to earn their place. And so he issues out a decree. Women need to learn their place. And so, and later on, it's like, you got to watch out for these Jews, people, because they're going to destroy everything. All right, yeah. I decree now all Jews are going to be killed. You see, the laws of the land were determined by whoever was in power. And when God comes in and he gives a law to Moses, it was not about who's in power, it's about what is intrinsically right. And so there's a difference. That's why even in our country, it's a reflection of that. We believe in the rule of the king? No, the rule of law. And we just say it like it's a normal thing, but the whole idea, the concept of rule of law came from God himself, that we would be a country that's governed by laws, not a country that is governed by who's got the most power. And so it was this revolutionary thing. And so there was like We'll get more in detail into this later on in the series this summer, but just kind of give you a biblical overview of the laws is that there were basically three general categories of law. There were civil laws, which because the nation, that the people of God was also a country, was also a nation to itself. They had to have laws about property and about lawsuits and things like that, the same way that we have those kind of laws. And so, whereas now in the 21st century that the people of God are made up of people around the world of many different cultures and nations, civil laws are just not really applicable now because we have civil laws in other realms. And so to A.J. Jacobs, who's trying to go out and kind of abide by all these laws, he doesn't quite understand that this was a story and this was a unique time in this story that where you needed to have these laws for the people who were being governed by these laws. And then on top of those, and by the way, this is the problem that Islam has right now. Islam cannot understand that the Sharia law that Muhammad instituted in 600, they're trying to institute that right now. And it's causing a lot of problems with people who are going that direction. So there were civil laws, there was also ritual laws, and these had to do with teaching people what it means to be clean, what holiness is. And now, just so you know, the senior pastoral staff here wholeheartedly agrees with some of these, like Leviticus 13:40, which says, a man who has lost his hair and is bald is clean. I'm just saying, you know, and Alex, he's working his way towards cleanliness, so He's on the path. He's got the beard, but you know he's the thatch is kind of falling a little bit. So someday he'll be as holy as Pastor Bobby and Pastor Chris, myself. Clayton, he's got a long way to go. Tim, he's got a long way to go. You know, they just got all that hair. But the whole point of those ritual laws was to teach about there is a holiness and there is a cleanliness, and then when it got distorted to believe that, you know, somehow the law was supposed to be meticulously followed for the sake of the law, like it was this legalistic thing, Jesus comes and says, listen. It's not about the food you eat. It's about the heart and what flows out of the heart that makes somebody clean or unclean. You go over Mark chapter 7, and he says, you know, nothing outside the person can defile them. Rather, it's what's coming out of the person that defiles them. It was always about the heart. And if you go over to Jeremiah chapter 31, he says, I foresee a day, I have this vision that the whole plan here by having all these laws is the vision is that one day I will write my law on their hearts. Kind of like when you have a five-year-old, you have to tell your five-year-old, you know, they get in trouble if they don't look both ways before they cross the street, right? They have to stop, look both ways, hold hand, whatever it is, before they cross the street. Why? Because your hope is that someday you won't have to hold their hand. Or for instance, in our country, there was just recently a decision on affirmative action. Now, if you came here from another country and you didn't know the story of America, you would have no idea what the purpose of affirmative action is, okay? You see, but if you know the story of America, you understand that there was a day and a time when we had slavery. There was a day and a time when we got rid of slavery, but that didn't get rid of the problem, did it? So they had to come up with other legislation, and then they had segregation. The idea was we'll be separate but equal. Please. Okay. So then we're like, okay, we're going to get rid of segregation because that's wrong. And so when they got rid of segregation, that solved all the problems, right? There was no more racism in America. No, they realized that there was still going on. And so they had to institute affirmative action to make sure. Now, was the goal of affirmative action to make sure that every institution and every school was exactly a percentage racially picture of all of greater America? No. The goal was the dream. What was the dream? That there would be one day where people would be judged not on the color of their sin, but on the content of their character. That's the dream, right? That's what we're all living for. Now, will affirmative action always be necessary in America? I don't know. Our hope, our dream is that one day there'll be a generation that doesn't care about color. That now that so many people have been able to go through the ranks and have been given an opportunity to prove it doesn't matter what color your skin is. It matters who you are and what you make of it. And I love the fact that we have a black president because it's one of the ultimate things in America to say, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. And maybe there'll be a generation. Now that there's a generation that's growing up in a different society than we grew up, maybe there will come a day when the dream is so fully realized, you don't have to have the law in place anymore. Isn't that the American dream right now? Yeah? You with me? And that was the dream of the Old Testament. That there would be these laws, and that one day you get to the point where the law would be written on your heart. Like there was this law that said, if you have an olive orchard, it says, when you beat the olive trees to get all the olive to fall, it says, don't go back over the branches a second time. Leave what remains for the foreigner, for the fatherless, and for the widow. Now, was the point of that to say, good thing I grow apples? No, that wasn't the point of the whole thing. Or is the point to say, well, you know, I'm not a farmer, I'm in 21st century, so this law doesn't apply to me. Or is it maybe that when you're at Walmart and you're going grocery shopping that you pick up something else so you can bring it over to the food pantry to help the fatherless and the widows and the orphans and the needy in society? And do you have to have a law that says that? Or if you're the kind of person that Jesus Christ has been so impacted by the love of Jesus Christ, that just becomes the kind of thing that you would naturally do. The law should be written on your heart. You don't have to be told. And that's why at this church, we don't get up here and tell you, we don't mandate giving. You know, we don't look and say, okay, how much you make? How much you making, Matt? Okay, because I need a percentage of that. And if that's not here, you're out. Not a bad idea. No, what does Pastor Bobby say? Every week, you know, comes up and says, listen, if you've been impacted by God, return back a portion of what's his so that the ministry that's here at this church and around the world can continue to spread. And it's really on you that your heart might be changed. It's not a legalistic thing. Back in the day, it was legalistic. Now it's just, you know, it should be a heart thing that changes. And that's the goal. That's the hope of the law. So there were civil laws, there were ritual laws, and there were moral laws. Oh, by the way, one last thing with AJ. I didn't have time to show you the whole 20-minute presentation, but he's an agnostic. He doesn't believe in God or anything. But he talks in there, some of the things he learned. He says, part of the thing I had to do to live biblically was to every day give thanks. He says, I didn't really believe in a God to give thanks to, but every day I would give thanks. And he says, and it changed my heart and the way that I saw the world. I became a much more grateful person and a much happier person because of it. He talks about how he's a workaholic, but he had to observe Sabbath, and he began to realize there's more to life than just work. And it was interesting to see what he was saying there is exactly what the intention of the law was to do, and that is, I'm going to make you do something so you see the benefits, and eventually you just do it on your own naturally. Does that make sense? And so you don't go back to the Old Testament laws because you're missing the story. They served a purpose in the story. Maybe you do. Maybe there's parts of it you do need to follow adherently, strictly. And maybe you need to do that so you can get your heart in the right place. So there were those laws. There was also moral laws like love your neighbor as yourself. By the way, that's from the Old Testament before Jesus ever restated it. Love the Lord your God, all your heart, soul, and mind. That's all in the Old Testament. And Jesus restates them. So Act 1 was creation, Act 2 was the fall, Act 3 was God beginning to woo back all of creation and rise up a people that he could work through, and Act 4, of course, is the culmination of everything that's come before that, and that is the coming of Jesus Christ, God himself, to redeem humanity. And Jesus, when he comes, he says, listen, all of the law and the prophets are fulfilled in me. In other words, this whole story from beginning to end is all about me. If you've never been to the Passover service we have every year on Passover night, you have to come. Because in there, my favorite part of the Passover narrative is when Jesus says, I have eagerly been waiting to tell you about the Passover tonight. It's as if he's saying, listen, I've been watching the Passover being celebrated 2,000 years and nobody knows what it's all about. I've been on this earth for 33 years and nobody knows what this thing is really about. And I got to sit here and keep my mouth shut and not tell you that this whole meal is about me. And so he tells all about it. And that's what we celebrate here with communion. It's a fulfillment of the Passover meal because everything in the story of creation and humanity and the fall, all was about Jesus Christ. And all leads up to him and fulfilled in him. And that's Act chapter 4. And then Act chapter 5 is the church. And that's where we begin to enter the story because the church began in the book of Acts when Jesus is ascended to heaven. And then there's a church, and the church's mission is to take this good news and share it throughout the world. And we are a part of Act 5 of the story. And of course, one day we look forward to Act 6, which is where Jesus comes again, and we live together with him for all eternity. And so when you begin to see Acts 1 through 6 in its totality, you begin to understand, yes, this life really is about nothing more than having a loving relationship with God that you'll enjoy for all eternity. But if you don't understand the 6 acts of the Bible, you'll start thinking, I don't know what God wants out of me, but you know, it's just a bunch of rules, it's just a thing I have to go do. No, I don't want you to go down the path of AJ and think that the Bible is something you have to do or decide, you know, it's just a thing you just have to pick and choose randomly what you're going to do. No, no, you have to understand the story. And my hope is that this summer, you'll understand the story, so you'll understand your place in his story. Would you join with me as we pray? Father, I thank you for the story of your great love, that the Bible is not a story of wrath. It is not primarily a story of condemnation. Rather, Father, it's a love story. And in the story, we read about a father who loves his son so much that he's out looking for him every night, then runs out to greet him when he comes home. This story is about a husband who's so in love with his wife that even though she's unfaithful to him, he takes her back time and time and time again. This story is about a lost sheep that a shepherd would leave every other sheep and go and search for. And when that sheep is found, all of heaven would rejoice. And this morning, Father, may we realize that we're that prodigal son, we're that wayward wife, we're that lost sheep. I know that you're calling us back into relationship with you. And in Jesus' name we pray. Amen.
Thank you for listening to the Essential Church Podcast. Let me encourage you to pause for a moment and reflect on what you've heard. It's not the hearing of the word, but the application that makes all the difference.